WGXC is a listener-supported community radio station, and it is also a new platform for presenting innovative experimental works on the air. Tune in, WGXC 90.7 FM, Agra, Hudson, Catskill, and points beyond. Listen to special programs of performance, words, sounds, and other rare and delicious items. Transmitting the arts all day every Saturday, and weekdays after midnight. Here is there.
You are listening to Human Machine, a program that airs each Saturday morning on WGXC 90.7 FM. Research in various scientific fields examine a speculative next stage in human evolution. Many predict an imminent human transformation based on increasing computer processing speed and manufacture, which will merge technological and human architectures. In this series, we will present projects and research about the horizons of the human machine. The program alternates weekly between Jeremy Kelly's curation of machine systems influence composers and Maximilian Goldfarb's assembly of materials that depict the convergence of humans and technology. Episodes will be thematically arranged to cover topics such as autonomous vehicles, medicine, sexual relations, space inhabitation, nanotechnology, slavery, warfare, labor, bioresearch, prosthetics and agriculture, all areas examined in relation to our subject of human-machine advancement.
This week's episode of Human Machine will feature John Rothman's Kool-Aid Man in Second Life, an investigation of cultural behavior in simulated environments, Future Sounds of London, sound composition by Hildegard Westerkamp, and the Sony Cave Wave Stimulus Engine, a presentation on auditory research into the sound arena of medical facilities. These examples consider the impact of constructing controlled sight profiles, visual and auditory, as they augment our understanding and experience of perceived phenomena in the simulated or reconstructed environments in which we spend an increasing amount of our time.
Hey, Kool-Aid Man.
Hi, Nicholas. So you want to go sit down and chat somewhere?
Yeah. Do you know of a good place?
Yeah, I know a few places.
All right. So the first question of the interview is discussing this question about kind of your history and your kind of art education, I guess you could say, but also your kind of the early part of your career, which is like invested in cinema and film history. And I'm wondering how that kind of education or that fascination or that interest or that part of your kind of early part of your career has like spilled over into kind of more recent work.
Well, originally, you know, I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to tell stories. I studied literature and philosophy and film in preparation for what I thought would be a career in cinema. When I'm surfing for Google Street Views or, let's say, exploring Second Life, the narrative impulse is always there. An underlying theme or goal is a constant search for artistic tools and methods that best represent or reveal modern experience. So I look for ideas and inspiration from those who also struggle to represent, you know, their experience of modernity, whatever the time period or era. In fact, I believe that the different generations or time periods that have been termed modern are more similar than different. I mean, be it Chaucer or Corey Archangel, the artist has searched for how to represent and critically examine the present.
Oftentimes one can approach your work or look at your work through the lens of the appropriation or co-opting of what could be called like amateur technology or pop technology. Things like Google Maps, Second Life, Cafe Press, the 3D warehouse, stuff like that. And I'm wondering how that influences the process of your work, whether it influences it from the onset or whether it influences it from the middle, or is it an afterthought?
Like I said, literature and cinema are big influences, but equally inspiring are the things that I consume and experience every day surfing the internet and exploring the emerging virtual worlds like Second Life, for example. It's not so much the amateur technologies themselves that inspire me, but what amateurs are doing with these technologies, what they are using the technologies to create. That's what really gets me excited. I just love looking at stuff that people have created without the intention of it being called art. I mean, stuff that is being made by people semi-naively who are simply excited to create things. And I think this enthusiasm is shared by many of my colleagues. You know, there's an aspect to Second Life that is grotesquely kitsch, and I can't help but loving this aspect. I think we've reached a point now, my generation, where we don't even know whether we're celebrating something and saying it's great and affirming it, or if we are engaging in an ironic critique and mocking it. We've almost collapsed the two.
Works like Brand New Page Up and Woods of Arcady, they operate as a kind of collision between this pop iconography and high art and high culture, certainly kind of like high modernism, you know, referring back to a couple questions ago. And I'm wondering how these encounters kind of maybe happen through the process of your work, but also, It seems as though it's kind of an inevitable result of the kind of jurisdictions that you're dealing with. You know, it seems like, I think I suggested elsewhere, these areas are kind of ripe for these kind of collisions. So I'm just wondering, do you feel yourself kind of like stumbling into these, or do you feel yourself already observing them and wanting to call attention?
Well, part of me feels like I've completely and artistically surrendered to this present reality where there is no dichotomy between high and low. I think for a Dadaist in the early 20th century, there still existed a certain intellectual rigidity and a perceived distinction between high and low, and so they were able to react against the social existence of this dichotomy. But for my generation, I feel like there's this distinction between high and low art or culture is pretty much like dissipated. I don't think anybody could really claim that anymore, that this is culture and this is not culture. I mean, our art pretty much assimilates everything, so there's nothing really to react against in that respect. I think I was born into a time that was already groundless, and I think what makes this generation, or maybe the past few generations, unique, is that we don't have any reference points. We were born into a groundless, ahistorical reality. And I think that because of this, there's this underlying sense, and I find this in all the subcultures or countercultures that I've encountered, that there's a sense that we're completely impotent of making any true revolutionary critique, and that in a way there's no escaping this this kind of centralist monster where our authority is ambiguous or so obscure and so nameless. I think there is this helplessness, and that we all feel, and we all feel it, and so we retreat or repress it and displace it. But it can't help but return, remanifest in different ways, and or there's a certain playful irony that I find that is also tragic at the same time.
I mean, a kind of follow-up question to that is that, you know, a lot of this sounds very pessimistic, yet the work seems very optimistic. Yeah. You know, the work seems, is lighthearted, you know, and it definitely reintroduces that playfulness, as opposed to being like anthropological or something, you know, removed or distant or something.
I think maybe it's just because I'm really enjoying the act of exploring these virtual worlds. There's a genuine excitement there. That's a good question. It's like, how come we can take so much pleasure in a movie in which all humankind is completely annihilated? We've reached a point where we're enjoying our own nightmares.
Recently, you were involved in this show in San Francisco, this Avatar 4D show organized by the Just Chillin' crew. And it showcased a large group of kind of emerging net artists that are kind of working in the same or working with the same vernacular and vocabulary that you're working with. And I'm wondering how that sense of community within that group of people has influenced your work, or has instigated kind of like ongoing collaborations with other makers.
I think you're right. I think there is a real dialogue that's going on. It first crystallized with the blog format several years ago, and internet surfing clubs like Nasty Nets. But it has just expanded and mutated ever since. I think with the advent of exhibiting work online, one can respond almost instantaneously to each other, no matter where one lives. So I think this new form of distribution allows for a certain direct response that sometimes almost resembles a real-time conversation with fast-paced aesthetic and conceptual exchanges. I also think that the web encourages a certain lightness and nonchalance, a disrespect for the preciousness of the physical object, and this is somewhat liberating, although there's still plenty of fetishization that's occurring. Sometimes I feel like there is a sense in which we're all collaborating, in analyzing and finding structure in this seemingly formless overflow of information that we're constantly bombarded with every day. And with this growth of the web, I think this dialogue between internet artists is becoming less and less of a conversation limited to the aesthetics and signs and symbols of the internet, and it's becoming more of a conversation just about everyday culture and everyday reality.
In the Kool-Aid Man tours, you get the sense when you're kind of watching them that there's a transition point between documentation of the tours that you give and this other kind of like process of self-discovery, and of either of you personally or your character or somewhere in between those. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about the transition or how that transition happened for you going into this environment, or how that transition has kind of occurred as a result of giving these tours.
In both my works in virtual worlds, in both Google Street View and Second Life, there's a remarkably similar pattern. It begins with the absolute joy of an explorer discovering a new world that can be searched and investigated endlessly. Like in Street View, I first believed that I had found a more truthful and more transparent world because of the seemingly unbiased, neutral way in which reality was photographed, and also because of just the sheer vastness of the project. And in Second Life, I first found individuals who did not always describe themselves as artists, but who created with a passion that was totally inspiring. Second Life is the ultimate tourist destination. It's an endless expanse where different symbols float around together equally and free from the weight of history. Turbocharged Las Vegas and Dubai combined. It's where every possibility and combination of landscape and architecture can exist. Like Google pointing to its own copyright in every Street View image, Second Life was an artificial world that admitted its artificiality, and one that best represented the anarchic psyche of the internet. And you know, I was just excited to document my discoveries and share it through my tours. But the same process unfolded with both Street View and Second Life, where the historical role of the artist, the perspective of the artist, slowly entered. And this is also connects with my earlier studies, where I had learned that to be able to see reality within one's own art, you know, you have to be worthy of it. I think I came to realize that Second Life, like Street View, it reveals a lot about the present. It reveals a world that is totally constructed, groundless, with no reference points. Like I said, I think the artist must be committed, must incorporate some moral dimension, which inevitably means that there are dichotomies, if not high and low, something about valuing the human being, recognizing the significance and worth of individuals.
When people use, when artists use MMOs, or like massive multiplayer online platforms, there's this kind of nascent collaboration between users and the artist. In the Kool-Aid Man tours, in the promos, there is a sense of distance between your avatar and others. And do you ever feel that you have a reluctance to expose too much of the user's experience, or is there a genuine separation that you feel within the SL community?
There's a sense of distance, yes. There's a sense of distance between myself and the SL community. I think Kool-Aid Man, as an avatar, functions differently than most other avatars. Many avatars in Second Life are some form of representation or extension, idealized or other, of their owners. I think sometimes Kool-Aid Man's presence is unnerving. And sometimes when I look at Kool-Aid Man's smile, it terrifies me. There are those who believe that when dreams become reality, they become nightmares. And perhaps Kool-Aid Man in his tours transforms our experience of Second Life in a way that highlights this possibility. The work I create when I'm reframing or adopting the role of a member of the community may not free us, but I hope that it points to the conditions under which we are trapped.
Machines make people irrelevant.
So what are you gonna do? So what are you gonna do? So what are you gonna do? So what are you gonna do?
So I'm Peter Otto with Edelstein, and we were fortunate enough to receive a CSRO grant to further some work that we began, starting with a project called CaveCAD, which has then more recently been extended to the domain of audio and audio simulation in service of healthcare environments. So Eve is going to do a lot of the talking here.
We just wanted to reflect on the fact that we haven't done this work alone. We've got a large number of collaborators that have come from a variety of disciplines, including biomedical engineering, neuroscience, and a number of the sonic team that are both computational and acoustic specialists. We also wanted to acknowledge the funding that we've received from HMC Architects. The field of architecture has recognized that the process of design is a sequence that's out of time with the needs of the clients. And so part of our mission is to answer what healthcare providers are highlighting it as a dramatic need in hospital environments for the improvement of design to support not only the patients but the providers of care. So we had the fortune of introducing to 100 of the medical leaders from UCSD health systems to the facilities and innovations at Cal IT2, and what was very clear was a deep interest in the acoustic environment in healthcare. And if you read the literature from the Institute of Medicine and the American Medical Association World Health Organizations, you realize that there are a great number of actual risks to both patients and caregivers that are derived from the environment itself. We know that there is a risk of medication error that can lead to fatality or serious adverse events simply because of the acoustic environment. And that includes the masking of detection of body sounds and the impedance of speech perception, along with the increase in stress that you encounter if you imagine yourself sitting by a freeway and listening to the din of noise there and then walk away. You realize how much the impact of noise can have on the stress of people who spend decades within these healthcare environments. And that's not just the patients, it's the staff as well. So our mission has been to combine our sciences, engineering, and sense of space with this healthcare mission. And so we actually have gone through Thornton Hospital, Hillcrest Hospital, a number of other hospitals measuring the incidence of care. And if you're not certain that this is really a problem, if you look at the graph, what you see in blue is acceptable sound levels to not induce noise-induced hearing loss. So this unit wouldn't be closed down. This EDU wouldn't be closed down because it was too loud. However, it is louder, 40 dB louder than the World Health Organization recommends. If, on the other hand, you change your meter to recording average sounds and record impulse sound, you see that the noise levels rise above 80 dB. They get to 120 dB at shift change. When every piece of equipment is going, when every staff member must communicate to the staff member leaving shift the status of their patient. This is when critical information is passed, and yet it is as loud as a jet engine. And so we began looking at some very specific parameters that we know have been related to fatalities and serious adverse events. There's a group of medications known as sound-alike, look-alike medications. They've been identified by the Joint Commission as being affiliated or associated with injury. And one of the suggestions on how to manage this was to tag the bins in pharmacy that are either look-alike or sound-alike. What you find when you go to a pharmacy is that there are so many bins tagged. it's not helping. So we started saying, how can we change the acoustic profile of the environment itself in order to reduce this type of error?
Let's just look at this slide for a moment. This is a slide that was taken from one of the local healthcare facilities, and this is the room where medication for patients is dispensed. And I did some recording of ambient noise in that environment, and I was seeing spikes at 90 decibels and 100 decibels. We also, this room was actually kind of a converted closet, so it was very, very tight. It was maybe 8 feet wide or so, and you can see that there are hundreds, and not one or 200, but hundreds and hundreds of medications here. And at the moment we were there, this probably doesn't indicate the true lighting condition. So we found both lighting and audibility problems in this space. And this was not a sort of minor healthcare center tucked away in some rural area. This is a major healthcare center here in San Diego, and the data that we just saw on charted noise characteristics was from another leading healthcare center in the U.S. in the eastern United States. So these are not we're not sort of poking around looking for the worst cases. These are really typical cases that that we found.
And if you think about it, average speech is about 45 dB, conversational speech is about 60, 70, and if we've found 90 dB in these sites, then we are so far above speech intelligibility that we've got real problems. So what we wanted to do was harness the technologies here at Cal IT2, and we had been working on new software to create virtual sound scenes in the cave. So we've actually imported models of patient rooms that are going to be built in the new Jacobs Medical Center, and then began looking at how we could model those spaces to understand where sounds emanated from, how those spaces could be modified either by finishes or by juxtaposition, and how we might create evidence-based design studies to help us to inform design and to create a system that we can use to go through hospitals and test the impact of acoustic changes on outcome measures. And so here you see us, and if you had a chance to go to the Star Cave beforehand, you'll have seen this, and if not, try afterwards. What you'll see is a distributed nursing station with two rooms that are populated by avatar teams that are talking to each other with real clinical recordings. Now, if we go to the typical acoustic modeler, they don't use real clinical recordings necessarily, and furthermore, their algorithms are designed for theaters and concert halls. We have an entirely different situation here, yet this is a life and death situation. And so we've begun to develop a series of systems that enables us to step inside the hospital environment with realism and then test how we can improve outcomes.
So a project that began with something called CaveCAD, which is a seemingly obvious extension of the concept of a CAD type of environment for designing architectural spaces, being imported and built up in this immersive surround situation that we have in VR environments, has spawned a new media form, which we're calling SonicCave. And SonicCave is meant, in its finished form, will be a real-time sound renderer that will essentially follow modifications to a newly designed room or environment and, let's say, allow the user to see what the sonic characteristics of a room might be. If I put carpet on the floor, no, I want to change that to concrete floor. No, I want to add one glass wall. No, let's see what it sounds like if we put thick curtains over that glass. So essentially, the luxury of being able to improvise and innovate based on real-world simulations that are following both the architectural and the sonic implications of design. So There's a couple ways that we do that. We can model existing sources through the use of convolution filters and reverbs, and we've done that in one of the demos that you can see in the cave here is take a walk, a virtual walk down the hallway just outside of this room and experience the real acoustical signature of that space, both the reverb as well as the spectral signature. And then we're beyond that, we're working in what we call predictive sonification, which is creating architectural models from a mathematical model that will allow us to accurately predict the reflections, the absorption characteristics, not only of the structure itself, but also the finished materials, and then actually walk into that space and see what it sounds like. Joachim Gossmann, who's one of our PhD candidates in the music department and an expert in spatial audio, is solving this very, very difficult problem and is making very good progress to date. You can see his demo in the SPAT lab.
What you may also have been able to see in the Star Cave is this CaveCAD software where you can real-time interactively modify design. And what's unique about this, because we've been able to do this for some time with CAD, is to stand inside of a building design while you're designing it. So the architects are very excited about this because this completely turns around the experience of design. Usually what happens is you design it in 2D, you relay it into a vertical elevation, and then after much processing, you offline, you get to walk inside this building, and finally you show your clients your clinicians, one or two options. Now you can actually have everybody gathered inside to look at the consequences of design, and with Sonicave to hear the consequences of design.
I should say that here at CalIT, one of our great strengths is diverse facilities. So you can imagine that there might be some constraints in doing this kind of design work in the Star Cave, which is, after all, about 10 feet wide and is made of 15 hard surfaces and rear screen projection. So it's highly optimized for the visual domain, but not so well optimized for the auditory domain. No problem. We can take our database into the spatial audio lab, which is highly optimized for audio, or we can take it into another facility, which we're now beginning to develop for this kind of application, which is in Reconfigurable Lab 4, just down the hall behind us, and see this work represented in 2D, but in a 10-screen visualization facility that is acoustically transparent and is highlighted by a full-fidelity 16-channel surround sound system. So what we have here is not a single solution, because there is no single solution to these this family of problems. What we have is a highly diverse group of facilities in which we can move from one lab to the next in order to focus on a particular aspect of the problem. One lab that might be 3D and much more optimized for visualization, another lab that might be 2D for visualization but 3D for audio.
And the other thing that we demonstrated, we knew that we wouldn't be able to fit 100 of our medical leaders into the Star Cave. And so using a collaborative cave software, we presented our Star Cave demonstration to them in the auditorium while some of our people were in the Star Cave and others were using the next cave in Saudi Arabia. The reason we wanted to show this model worked was, imagine a surgeon who happens to be in Tokyo who wants to consult during a surgery that's occurring here in San Diego and to also have information fed to another resource at Johns Hopkins. And so by being able to link not only different cave technologies, but link people in real time all around the world, you can create collaborative efforts, whether or not it's healthcare design or healthcare delivery. And so that's the image that you're seeing here on the scene. The panel of three screens on the right are actually showing our colleagues in Saudi Arabia who were looking at exactly the same building that we were looking at, and each one of us could pick up our wand and move through that building, or if it was a brain image, move through that brain image at any moment.
So, and it's important to point out that for scalability, we want to be able to look at one data set that's rendered in three different environments. So we've striven to develop a kind of a highly scalable interactive image and sound database that can be rendered at three different positions, but the interactivity with the data is independent of the controller. So essentially, control can move around. Two people in two different places can interact with the same data set, even if they're rendered differently. As I mentioned earlier, there is no one good fixed solution to this set of problems. And sometimes the cleverest architecture cannot make sound and noise characteristics in a busy environment behave the way that we want it to. And another aspect of our research here at UCSD in the Sonic Arts Group has been to look at wave field synthesis and to look at ways of better controlling electronically born sound for messaging and announcing and signaling and so forth and communications. We've developed a very small wave field synthesis engine, and it's something we now call Soundbender. And the idea here is, in a hospital environment or a critical care environment, there are places where you want sound to be, and there are places where you don't want that sound to be. And so, for example, we want to be able to signal to a nurse's station without the patients necessarily being disturbed by alerts and announcements. And this Soundbender will allow you to do that. This is a 12-inch, very small 12-inch array of 12 very inexpensive sound drivers. Each one of, and the 12 of these sound drivers are emitting three separate, very narrowly focused sound beams. And I've got a little video that shows how it works. Here you can see a very tightly structured sound beam in the center. Red is hot or loud. Blue is very little sound energy. And you can see that from the same array here, we're able to shape several different beams, and we can do that simultaneously. So here there's almost no sound energy. Here there's many decibels of sound energy. And here's a little video that'll...
So as you load the video, the people, each person that you see standing around the sound beam hears something entirely different despite being so close to each other.
So, for example, the center beam might be masking noise, and one beam might be a message for one particular person, and another beam might be another message. A little more level. So that's masking noise.
So here the camera is just walking around the front of this 12-inch array. So the speakers aren't moving, none of the electronics are moving, but the sound is being filtered to be directed and enhanced where you want it.
So we encourage you to have a look at this. It's running in the SPAT lab just down the hall and to the right.
I know that we're a little short on time, but I'd like to show this simulation if we can manage to get it in. What you see here is our virtual mock-up of the hospital environment with two medical teams in it and actual sound recordings of EKGs, people talking as they have to during their clinical duties, and a doctor giving orders for a certain medication to be prescribed. Let's see if you can figure out what that medication is. Can you turn up? Can you turn up the sound level, please? Let's try that again. Oh, by the way, this will be 120 dB in reality, but here we won't play it nearly that loud.
Anybody got a sound bender?
Yeah. All right. So let me go back to that first simulation. I would suggest that that's at about 60 dB and the real environment would be at least 90 dB. So let me play the next scene without that sound effect in the back. Same sound level from upstairs. So we obviously have to do something. Let me just try this one.
Administer 1 milligram hydromorphone by
So that's the difference between hydromorphone and hydromorphine. So by clicking the sound off for a moment, you could hear that the doctor was still ordering those medications in the background. But that identifies the problem that we're trying to deal with. And our concern is to be both preventative and proactive and enable people to participate in the improvement of this environment. What you see here is another question that we're addressing, which is the distribution of low frequency and other frequency sound waves that are very intense. A helicopter landing on top of a hospital, if it's on top of neonatals, newborn babies, it may indeed harm their hearing. And so it's another aspect that we're beginning to examine by using the StarCave. And here, most surprisingly to me, just by the recording of an IT closet, in other words, typical ventilation noise in this simulation of a hospital environment, completely masked out the sound of a heartbeat. You can just hear it in the background, but listen carefully. When we turn off the background noise, what a difference it makes to perception. So when people ask whether or not masking sound is appropriate, whether or not we can improve diagnostic ability using a stethoscope, one of our answers is yes, let's improve the environment of care so that we can reduce hospital-acquired injury and improve medical outcomes.
Thank you.
And sometimes when I look at Kool-Aid Man's smile, it terrifies me. There are those who believe that when dreams become reality, they become nightmares. And perhaps Kool-Aid Man in his tours transforms our experience of Second Life in a way that highlights this possibility. I create when I'm reframing or adopting the role of a member of the community may not free us, but I hope that it points to the conditions under which we are trapped.
You have been listening to the program Human Machine on WGXC. Listen on Saturday mornings to subsequent episodes, where we continue our conversation on the nature of being in an age of human-machine evolution.